Hey, Boker Tov, by welcome everybody to our, I guess, 5784. Yom Kippur is like the end of the year, but, okay, not just Rosh Hashanah. And of course, Vayihi Macharat, really, in many ways, the most important day of the year is the day after Yom Kippur to see what happens. So it's, very happy, Dr. Sokolo, you get to start our learning after Yom Kippur. So we greatly appreciate it and thank you very much. This series is being sponsored by Chesky and Deborah Rubin in memory of their fathers. And today is the first yahrzeit of Debbie's father, Chaim ben Menachem Meir. So we want to thank the Rubin family and that the fathers and Shammah should have an
You muted yourself.
Yeah. I'm sorry. At what point did I get muted? From the beginning?
Not at the beginning. Just at where you were about to wish the fathers and the neshamot aliyot.
Okay, why don't I start over again? I'm sorry, I did not realize I muted myself, but as I began to say, this series is being sponsored by Chesky and Deborah Rubin in memory of their fathers, and today is the first yahrzeit of Debbie's father, Chaim ben Menachem Meir, and we want to wish the family well, and the Shammah should have an Ali. We want to wish them and all of us long life and good health, and we should come together to study Torah for good occasions. Okay, thank you. And Dr. Sokolo, Vakasha.
Okay. So we are actually finally caught up with ourselves. We're even a little bit ahead of ourselves. We're going to look at the haftarot of the end of Sukkot. We looked at the haftarot of the first 2 days of Sukkot last week. So again, as I said, we're keeping ahead of everything. We're ahead of the curve, so to speak. So I'd like to look today with you at the haftarot of Shmini Atzeret and of Simchat Torah. So we'll spend a bit of time actually talking about the significance of the word Atzeret, because we've encountered it on previous occasions. On previous occasions, we've taken note of the fact that while the eighth day of Sukkot is referred to as Atzeret, on one occasion, so is the last day of Pesach, referred to as Atzeret. And in Mishnaic and Talmudic parlance, the holiday of Shavuot is called Atzeret. So we have the term Atzeret applied to each and every one of the three principal festivals. So we'll spend a little time at the outset having a look at the significance, or at least some interpretations of the significance of the term Atzeret, and then we'll have a look at the Haftarot themselves. So let me let you all in here, and here we go. Okay, so we're here with our go-to Gemara, so to speak. The one in Masechet Megillah, which alerts us to the proper Torah and Haftarah readings for all of the principal holidays. So, referring to the end of the holiday of Sukkot, the Gemara says, Yom Tov Acharon, right, the last day of Sukkot, which is Shmini Atzeret, Korin Kol HaBechor. That's a kind of standard reading for the end of holidays. Mitzvot v'chukim u'bechor. This is simply a synopsis of what's contained in that Torah reading. Mitzvot holidays, mitzvot that are appropriate for that day. And then the maftir is vayhi kechalot Shlomo. When Shlomo completed, when he completed what? We'll see in a moment. When he completed the construction of the first Beit HaMikdash. So there is clearly some association between the conclusion of the holiday of Sukkot and the conclusion of the period of time and the efforts that were invested by Shlomo HaMelech into the construction of the first Beit HaMikdash. Okay. Then it says, Lemachar. Now, this is clearly a piece of Talmud and not a piece of Mishnah, because in the land of Israel, in the Mishnah, there is only one day at the end of Sukkot. There would not be a machar. There is only a machar, an extra day, a day after Shmini Atzeret, in the diaspora. So the Gemara says l'machar, on the day following Shmini Atzeret, korin zot v'zot ha-bracha, right? That's the day that we call Simchat Torah, the day on which we read the final portion of Sefer Devarim. And then it says, u'maftirin, and what is the haftarah? Vayamod Shlomo. The King Solomon stood up. Now, if we had a Sefer Melachim, a first book of Kings, chapter 8, opened in front of us, we would see that the haftarah of Shmini Atzeret, the one that describes the conclusion of the construction of the Beit HaMikdash, is followed immediately by a special prayer that King Solomon recited on that occasion. And the opening, the introduction to that special prayer consists of the words, Vayamod Shlomo. King Solomon stood up, right, at the ceremony marking the celebration, marking the inauguration of the first Beit HaMikdash. He stood up and he recited a prayer. And it's a very important, very significant prayer. It is probably the longest continuous prayer recorded in the Bible. So it's a very significant prayer. Okay? And arguably, at least according to the Talmud, that would be the haftarah of Simchat Torah. Any of you who can think back as far as last year's Simchat Torah might very well recall that that's not at all the haftarah that we read. I can say we rather confidently because I don't know of any congregations that don't read a different haftarah for Simchat Torah. They read the haftarah that consists of the first chapter of the book of Joshua, because since Vizot HaBracha, since Sefer Devarim ends with the death and burial of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? It's simply a logical extension to attach the haftarah that tells us about how Joshua succeeded Moses. Okay. Now, this did not escape notice of the Tosafot. The scholars, among them students of Rashi living in northern France and elsewhere in Western Europe, during the 12th and 13th centuries. And they said as follows. They cited the Gemara, L'machar, that would be on the day after Shmini Atzeret, our Simchat Torah, Karina Mizot HaBracha, that's what the Talmud says. The Talmud also says, Maftirin, what is the proper Haftarah? Vayamod Shlomo. So the Tosafists make the following observation. V'yesh Mekomot, that already in the 12th or 13th century, they were aware of the fact that there were Jewish communities, Shenahagula Haftir, who on Simchat Torah had a different custom. And they read as the Haftarah, Vayi Acharei Mot Moshe, the first chapter in the book of Joshua. So the question is that proper? It's clearly not what's indicated in the Talmud, but there are many legitimate Jewish customs that have no indication in the Talmud. So the Tosafists say, no, this is a shibush. This, in fact, is erroneous. And the implication of erroneous is that it's improper. Why? Shahare Hashas ein Omer kein. Because not only does it not have a source in Talmudic literature, it's an explicit contradiction to a Talmudic statement. However, in support of this custom, they say, Yesh Omrim, that there are those who maintain, Sherav Hai Gaon Tiken Lomar Vayi Acharei Mot Moshe, that this custom at least originated with not merely one of the Gaonim, actually the very last of the Gaonim, Rav Haya Gaon, he was not only the last of the Gaonim, he is considered by many to have been one of, if not the most significant. And therefore, the Tosafists are saying that although this custom has no source in the Talmud, they're suggesting or implying that if indeed it were correct that the custom was originated with, or that it was at least confirmed by Rav Haya Gaon, then at least it has, if not two legs to stand on, at least it's got, you know, one leg to stand on. However, the Tosafot say, Aval einan yodin hasvara, that even if this custom were introduced by, or at least was affirmed by Rav Haya Gaon, we simply do not know why anybody thought it was necessary to replace the Haftarah that the Talmud instructs us to read. Amai Shina Seder Hashas, we do not know why Rav Haya Gaon, or anyone for that matter, would have changed the Talmudic custom. Okay. So we, however, don't follow the advice of the Tosafot, and we continue in the custom that they challenged, the custom of accompanying the reading of the very end of Sefer Devarim with the very beginning of Sefer Yoshua. Okay. Now, as I said, I wanted, before we got into the Haftarah, to say a little something about the significance of the name Atzeret. Now, the verb la'atzor is something that, if you've ever driven in Israel, even if you've only been a pedestrian, but certainly if you've driven in Israel, you'll probably recognize, because those are the letters that are emblazoned on stop signs. Okay? Stop signs in Israel, as in Europe, have the palm of a hand, right, telling you to stop. Okay? And the word ayin tzadi vav resh, atzor, emblazoned across it. So clearly, the root word of atzeret has something to do with ending, stopping, finishing, completing, something along those lines. Okay. What I want to read with you, and we'll do it in English on account of the constraints of time, is drawn from the commentary on the word atzeret of the Sephorno, Rabbi Ovadia of Sephorno. Sephorno was a city in Italy, lived at the end of the 15th century. That gave him access to a lot of the earlier medieval commentaries. And coming from Italy, which at the time was enjoying the Renaissance, it gave him also a particularly humanistic view that is reflected in his commentaries. So he says as follows. The concept of Atzeret, he says, should be distinguished from a similar concept, which is the concept of Shabbat. Shabbat also essentially means to stop something, to stop working, okay? So he says that the latter, the concept of Shabbat, pertains to abstaining from ordinary secular activities, right, from weekday activities, okay? Whereas the former, atzeret, entails spending a certain amount of time performing holy tasks, meaning Shabbat is the cessation of work. Atzeret is, well, okay, if you're not going to work, then what are you going to do to fill up the time? So he says that that's what atzeret is. Atzeret implies that the time that you have gained, the leisure time that you've gained through the cessation from your workday activities, should be spent in the performance of certain holy tasks, such as studying Torah, engaging in communal prayer. And he points out that the root ayin tzadi resh occurs in this context in several verses. He cites a verse in the book of Samuel, a verse in the book of Yoel, a verse in the book of Kings. All in the sense, coming to the next page, it is in this sense, that is to say, the sense of Hatzeret being a time in which you can engage in religious or spiritual activities, that the Torah refers to the day following the seventh day of Sukkot festival, as atzeret, ubayom hashmini, atzeret tihye lachem. Because the atzeret is an assembly for God. That is to say, people who are in Jerusalem because of the festival of Sukkot remain there, and they gather together, the pilgrims for the Sukkot festival to Jerusalem being detained there for an additional day, right? Rather than returning home at the end of the seventh day of Sukkot, which is Hoshana Rabbah, they stay over an extra day. On the day after the completion of these festivities, the pilgrims of Sukkot festival really pertaining to an additional day. The joy on that day was to be a Torah-inspired and oriented joy, akin to when David says in Psalms, Yismach Yisrael, what is a truly Jewish celebration? Be'osav, a celebration that focuses on the relationship between the Jewish people and their creator and God. Further, he says, we find that the description of family dinners held in the home of Job's children, seven sons and three daughters, at set intervals, such festivals were get-togethers were held. On the day after the completion of these festivities, this is in the very beginning, the first chapter of the book of Job, their father, Job, Eov, would send word to them, to his children, to sanctify themselves and rise early in the morning, right, and offer sacrifices to atone for the possibility that they may have been remiss and committed some misdemeanor which would have pleased God. So again, notice what he's saying. He's telling us that after something that takes 7 days, okay, if we want to acknowledge that this, that the previous 7 days, right, although they're over, we still have some sort of attachment to them, some sort of longing for them, that they have some sort of lasting effect on us, then we do something special on that eighth day. Okay? So, for example, on the seventh day after the Exodus from Egypt, the Israelites took time out to sing a song of thanksgiving to God for their final delivery from the pursuing Egyptians. Right? According to biblical chronology and according to Jewish tradition, the Kriyat Yam Suf, the splitting of the sea, took place on the seventh day following the Exodus from Egypt. So then, that ended a period of 7 days, the first seven days that they were enjoying their freedom. So this too was marked, this occasion was marked by something religious, a religious celebration, namely their participation in the singing of the song at the sea, okay, devoted, as he says, to the contemplation of the great miracle that occurred on that occasion. Okay. Furthermore, on the 50th day after the Exodus, when the Israelites in a great assembly at Mount Sinai spent the day contemplating their elevation to an almost supernatural people. So here in this case, the period of time is not one of 7 days, but it's one of 50 days or 49 days. We could, I suppose, arguably say it's 7 weeks of 7 days. So it's really a multiple of seven. It's not necessary. He's not suggesting that all religious occasions consist of 7 days and therefore they have to be marked on the eighth day. He's saying that anytime there is a fixed period of time that marks a significant moment in Jewish life, there is a tendency to add something to it. So therefore, on the 50th day after the Exodus was the holiday that we call Shavuot, the day on which the Torah was given. Okay? So, he says, the people spent the day contemplating their elevation to an almost supernatural people through the receipt of the Torah. This day was also subsequently observed as an Atzeret. He said that accounts for the fact that the Mishnah and the Talmud refer to the holiday of Shavuot as Atzeret. That is to say, just as Shmini Atzeret links that day to the holiday of Sukkot that preceded it, and just as I mentioned in the introduction, that there is at least one Torah verse that refers to the last day of the holiday of Pesach as an Atzeret, so that too would link it to the previous 7 days of the holiday. So it is that because the holiday of Shavuot has an attachment to the holiday of Pesach, although it precedes it not by 7 days, but by 50 days, it also warrants being called an Atzeret. Although in the Torah, this day is never referred to as such. As I said, it's only a Mishnaic and Talmudic designation. However, he asks a question, obvious one, the reason why the Torah itself does not refer to this day as an Atzeret, if after all his logic is correct, and if indeed it's seen as an annex, so to speak, a postscript, an appendix to the previous 50 days, should it not so be called in the Torah itself? He says it may be the fact that shortly thereafter, that is almost immediately after the Torah was given, all the accomplishments of this day were lost because of the building of the golden calf, and the Jewish people were even commanded to divest themselves of the jewelry they had worn in commemoration of that wonderful day. So he says basically that since although it was an atzeret, because when it started, the fact that unfortunately it didn't conclude on the same note on which it began is simply enough of a reason or a justification for the Torah not to refer to it as an atzeret. So it waited until the Mishnah before that title was restored to it. So I think this gives us a somewhat better appreciation of the holiday of Shmini Atzeret. So, and I'll just point out parenthetically that the question of whether Shmini Atzeret is an independent holiday, or as I've referred to it, an appendix to the holiday of Sukkot, has certain halachic ramifications. And indeed, there are discussions in the Talmud. The question that the Talmud asks is, Shmini regel bifnei atzmo, is Shmini Atzeret an independent holiday, or is it merely the eighth day of Sukkot? And as I said, there are any one of a number of halachic ramifications. I'll give you just a very brief one. In Kiddush, or in the Amidah, in Ya'aleh V'Yavo that we recite on the eighth day of Sukkot, do we continue to refer to it as Chag HaSukkot, Zman Simchatenu, or do we refer to it as Shmini Atzeret HaChag? The fact that we refer to it as Shmini Atzeret HaChag would seem to indicate that we perceive of it as being an independent holiday, but we yet take note of the fact that it has some sort of a relationship to the holiday of Sukkot that preceded it. Say, by the way, I know that there are a variety of different texts in Sidurim. Shmini Atzeret HaChag Hazeh, Chag Shmini Atzeret Hazeh. I think that the proper one is to call it Shmini Atzeret HaChag Hazeh, because it is the atzeret, it is the day of assembly, the leftover day to the chag, the holiday. We've already taken note when we discussed the haftarot of the first 2 days of Sukkot, that the Talmud invariably refers to the holiday of Sukkot simply as hechag, the holiday par excellence. Okay, another consequence of it would be, is there an obligation to eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeret? So you may know that there are people who will eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeret, and people who don't think that it's necessary to eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeret. The challenge, however, is to those who think that you do eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeret, and if you're one of them, you know the answer, and if not, find somebody who does and ask them, do they recite the bracha of Leshev Basukkah? That would be clearly an indication of the extent to which they regard that day as being an integral part of the holiday of Sukkot, as opposed to being some sort of an appendix to it. Okay. So with all of that, we can now have a look at the two haftarot. And since both of these haftarot actually are narratives, they come from narrative books. They come from Sefer Melachim in the case of Shmini Atzeret and Sefer Yehoshua in the case of Simchat Torah, there really isn't any difficult language in them. It's not like the haftarot we've looked at previously from the books of Yeshayahu or Yechezkel or Zechariah, which not only had somewhat complicated ideas, but certainly had rather complicated language. So this is pretty clear. So let's take a look, and as I noted at the beginning, recall that the haftarah of the second day of Sukkot consisted of the beginning of this same chapter in Sefer Melachim. Okay, so the haftarah of the first day of Sukkot, I'm sorry, the second day of Sukkot, described the actual completion of the construction of the first temple, followed by Solomon's prayer. Okay, that is what the Talmud advised us to read on Simchat Torah. But instead, we skip Solomon's prayer, and we continue in the same chapter in the Book of Kings with the concluding dozen or so verses in that chapter that describe something that happened after Solomon completed his prayer. So it begins, Vayikach Halot Shlomo Lehitpalel Al Hashem, when Solomon had finished his prayer, the prayer he addressed to God, et kol hatefilah v'hatechina hazot, the prayer, the supplication that he had recited, kam milifnei mizbach Hashem, he had been in the, he had stood in front of the altar. So he rose, right? Mikro al birkav, because he had been kneeling previously. The chapav prusot hashamayim, and as he knelt, his arms were reaching heavenwards. So now, vayamod, he stood up. Vayivarech et kol kahal Yisrael, and he now recited a blessing. He bestowed a blessing upon the Jewish people who had all gathered there for this momentous occasion. Kol gadol emor, out loud. Obviously, it had to be out loud because there was quite a large audience. And here we have the text of his blessing. Okay? So you'll see that I used some colors here significantly. Anything that pertains to prayer, I highlighted in yellow. Lehit paleel, the noun tfilah, the noun tchinah, and as you can see a little lower down, the verb hitchananti, to recite a request or a supplication. Okay? So those are the elements of prayer. Okay? Now, bluish, we have the description of the posture that he assumed when he was praying, okay, the kneeling and the arms stretched out to heaven, okay, something that we engaged in ourselves not too long ago, certainly within the last 24 hours, okay. And in green, things that pertain to the blessing that he bestowed upon the people. Vayivarech, to recite a blessing. Baruch, to be blessed. Dvaro hatov, the essence of the blessing, which of course is wishing somebody good. Okay. So, he stood up and he blessed the congregation of Israel with a loud voice, and he said as follows, beginning with verse 56. Blessed be Hashem, who has given rest to his people Israel. Hashem atam menucha le'amo Yisrael. You might recognize that phrase. It comes from some of the zmirot that we recite regularly on Shabbat. According to all that he promised, there has not failed one word of all of the good promise which he promised by the hand of Moses, his servant. That all of the good things that God promised the Jewish people in promises that were delivered to them by Moses, all of these things, says King Solomon, have now come to their fulfillment. May the Lord our God be with us. Yehi Hashem Elokeinu imanu, kasher hayayim avotenu al yaazedenu va'al yuchenu, a verse that we will recite in about another 10 days. It's part of the ceremony with which we open the Aron Kodesh on the night of Simchat Torah, preceding the Hakafot. So you can see where the authors and editors and redactors of the Siddur, right, were aware of which biblical verses are associated with which holidays and which festive occasions on the Jewish calendar. And he continues, verse 58, we also pray that God may incline our hearts to him, that we may walk in his ways and keep his commandments and his statutes and his ordinances, which he commanded our fathers. Furthermore, he says, V'yud varai ela asher chananti lefnei Hashem, krovim el Hashem Elokeinu yamam v'alayla. May all of the words that I recited just a moment before in prayer to God, may they be close to God. May God take them to heart, so to speak. La'asot, and what will God's reaction be? That God then will la'asot mishpat avdo u'mishpat amo Yisrael dvar yom biyomo. So that the cause of the Jewish people, the just cause of the Jewish people, will be pleaded by God on a daily basis. You may recognize this verse too. It appeared in the liturgy of the Yamim HaNoraim. Then follow on too. Leman dat kol amei haaretz, so that all of the peoples of the earth, here amei haaretz is Hebrew and not Yiddish, right? In Hebrew, an am haaretz simply means an ordinary person, proletariat, so to speak, right? Whereas in Yiddish, am haaretz means someone who is an ignoramus, okay? This is not the biblical sense. Biblical sense of amei haaretz is simply all the people in the world, okay? What should they come to know? Ki Hashem ha'elokim ein od. Hu ha'elokim ein od. Right? That there, God is the only deity. And therefore, as a consequence of this, he says to the people, Vayalav avchem shalem im Hashem elokeinu. Therefore, because God has done all that he promised to do, it's up to you now to keep up your end of the bargain, your end of the covenant, and that is to be whole, shalem, right? To be one with God, so to speak. Okay. And how can you get to be one with God? By walking in his statutes, lalechet bechukav, lishmor mitzvotav, observing his commandments, kayom hazeh, meaning that on this day, arguably, standing there in the presence of the newly inaugurated temple, right, the people certainly had put on not only their best clothes, but probably their best behavior. So Solomon is saying to them, your best behavior is something that behooves you on a daily basis. Okay. I guess I should point out I'll see. If I have time left, I'll come back to this. Okay. So, after Solomon finished his prayer and after he finished blessing the people, we're now told as follows, starting with verse 62. That now the king, Solomon, and all of the people of Israel who had gathered there for the inauguration of the Beit HaMikdash, offered sacrifices before Hashem. Okay? And Solomon offered for the sacrifice of peace offerings, shlamim, a particular type of sacrifice, which he offered to Hashem, the following, 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. Okay. Even if they had a legion of Kohanim standing by to slaughter the animals, arguably it must have taken an exceedingly long time to complete the slaughter of 22,000 oxen and 120,000 sheep. Not to mention the fact that at least arguably, technically, all sacrifices, once the temple was completed, sacrifices were permissible only on one altar. Right. So either the numbers here are a form of hyperbole, they're either a form of exaggeration, or we have to assume that even though they're referred to here as sacrifices, they were offerings more than sacrifices. What's the difference between an offering and a sacrifice? A sacrifice, arguably, is something that you're obliged to give. An offering is something that is voluntary. So it could very well be that what they did is that they slaughtered all of these sheep and oxen, not as sacred sacrifices, but rather as voluntary offerings. And since if their intent was only to sacrifice them so that they could have a festive meal, then possibly it wasn't necessary that they all be offered on the altar or even that they be slaughtered by Kohanim. Okay. So this, we are told, is how they dedicated the Beit HaMikdash. And the term that's used for the dedication of the Beit HaMikdash is the term vayachnechu. In the verb vayachnechu, you may recognize the noun chinuch. Chinuch is the modern Hebrew term for education. And I emphasize it's the modern Hebrew term for education. Not surprisingly, references to education in the pre-modern period don't use the word chinuch, really. Because, as you might expect, a biblical verb that lends itself much more naturally to the subject of learning and teaching and studying is the verb lamed mem dalad, from which we get the verb lilmod, to learn. We get the noun talmid, a student. We get the noun milamed, a teacher. Okay. In fact, education, and since the only form of education, Jewish education, was religious Jewish education in the pre-modern period, The term that's customarily used when speaking about Jewish education is Talmud Torah. Somehow in the 19th and 20th century, the practice grew of referring to education as chinuch. And it may very well have been taken from this instance, from the instance in which the dedication, first the dedication in the Torah, the dedication of the altar in the very first tabernacle in the Mishkan was called Chanukat HaMizbeach. And therefore, the dedication here of the temple also uses the word Chanukah. And since the word Chanukah later was enshrined in the Jewish cultural memory through the activities of the Hashmonaim, okay, so I guess somebody wanted to hearken back to that. And therefore, they switched from the use of Talmud Torah to Chinuch. But the question is just really, what is chinuch? If chinuch really is education, how do you educate an altar? How do you educate a building? So clearly, chet nun chaf doesn't only mean to educate. It obviously has a different meaning. So what I brought down here is an interesting thing. The definition of chinuch as supplied to us by Rashi. Rashi addresses the word chinuch when it appears early in the Torah in its description of the household servants or retainers who accompanied Avraham Avinu when he pursued the Mesopotamian kings who had taken his nephew Lot captive. And it says that he gathered them about, his chanichim, and he pursued them. So Rashi said, why are they called chanichim? Shechinech lemitzvot. So Rashi too gets the sense that something chinuch has something to do with teaching people, educating people. So he says that these householders were called chanichim because Abraham educated them in the performance of mitzvot. But now he gives a broader definition. V'hu l'shon hatchala t'nknisat ha'adam o kli la'omanut shehu atid la'amod bo. That any time you initiate or dedicate a person or an inanimate object to some sort of use or profession in which it is going to persevere, that, says Rashi, is called chinuch. Therefore, the first time you use the mizbeach, chinuch. The first time you use the temple, chinuch. And when you introduce a child to the alphabet or to Jewish learning, that too is worthy of being called chinuch. In fact, the examples that he gives are chanoch lana'ar, teach children, chanukat habayit, that's our example here of the dedication of the temple. And furthermore, he gives us a French definition of it. And he says, v'la'az, in old French, it's called enseigner, which, as you see in the translation, is old French for to teach or to instruct. Now, the interesting thing is that Rashi's old French glosses very frequently got miscopied by people who didn't understand old French. That's why, in fact, in some editions of Rashi, you'll find that the old French glosses were actually replaced with Yiddish glosses for an audience that certainly had no idea what old French was, but knew Yiddish, which, of course, misled many people into assuming that Rashi knew Yiddish, which he didn't. Okay. And in some other editions of Rashi's commentary here, rather than the French word, being spelled enseigner, it's spelled initié, which would suggest that Rashi saw that the word chinuch essentially means to initiate. And indeed, we find the identical definition in a commentary on the Mishnah by Maimonides. Maimonides says that the meaning of chinuch is habituation, right? Doing something over and over again by rote. And the word chinuch is used in these matters to refer metaphorically to the beginning of a process, as though a utensil were being accustomed to a specific task. Exactly what Rashi said. And Maimonides says this can be compared to a person who is first learning a specific science or virtue, which he repeats until he acquires it. So we see that while both Rashi and Maimonides saw some connection between chinuch and education, they also took note of the fact that it had a broader definition, which is more aligned with the verb to initiate or to dedicate. Okay. So as I said, just again, to look at the last section that we read rather quickly, again, you can just simply see by the highlightings. Okay. Again, in the purple, the highlightings refer to the process of sacrifices. The green, again, refer to the process through which the temple was dedicated and the reception that the dedication of the temple received on the part of Solomon and on the part of the people. And the critical line, okay, the critical line, which of course explains why it's attached to the holiday of Sukkot, is verse 65, Vaya'ash Shlomo ba'etahi. That is to say, contiguous with or consecutive to the dedication of the first Beit HaMikdash was a celebration of the holiday. Remember again, the holiday with a definite article and no further qualification is invariably a reference to the holiday of Sukkot. So clearly, the dedication of the temple was prior to Sukkot. How much before Sukkot was the dedication of the temple? It says that, here's the underlying passage at the end of that verse, that Solomon held the festival at that time, and all Israel with him, a great congregation, from the entrance of Hamat, which is all the way up in the north of Israel, to the brook of Egypt, which is all the way in the south, before Hashem, 7 days and 7 days, for a total of 14 days, and then, here it is, Bayom HaShmini, on the eighth day, Shilach et Ha'am, he told the people that the convocation was over and they could all go home. Now, arguably this eighth day is our Shmini Atzeret, the eighth day of Sukkot. But if the total celebration lasted 14 days, it means that it began a week before Sukkot. Since Sukkot begins on the 15th day of the month of Tishrei, then arguably the ceremony of the dedication of the temple began on the 8th of Tishrei. Now, if they celebrated for 14 days from the 8th of Tishrei through the 23rd of Tishrei, okay, it means that they also celebrated on the 10th of Tishrei. And therefore, as Rashi notes here, okay, nimtza, that the math is inescapable, says Rashi. Sha'achlu v'shatu biyom ha-kippurim. That the convocation, the dedication of the first temple, was such an overriding celebration that it even took precedence over Yom HaKippurim. Okay. And with that, we move, and it's rather quick here because it's rather all obvious in the text. We move to the Haftarah of our Haftarah of Simchat Torah, which, as I already mentioned, is the very beginning of the book of Joshua. In fact, it's seamless with the Torah reading. Okay, the only instance we have throughout the entire year where the Torah reading and the beginning and the reading of a Haftarah from one of the books of the prophets is seamless. The very first words after the last words in the Torah are Vayachare Mot Moshe Ebed Hashem, after the death of Moses, servant of God. Now notice again the highlighting. In every highlight in yellow is a reference to Moses. Every highlight in blue is a highlight to Joshua. Now take a look, just simply, let's count quickly. All of the references to Moses in the first chapter of the book of Joshua, how many references are there to Moses and how many references are there to Joshua himself? So counting the references to Moses, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Six, seven, eight, nine, ten. Okay. 10 references to Moses. How many references do you think there are to Joshua in the first chapter of the book of Joshua. I'll save you the trouble, 5. Okay. So again, you know, I'm not saying that this is deliberate. It could simply be a consequence of just what the author of this chapter found necessary to report to us. But it's significant. In a sense, it's basically telling us these are echoes of Moses, right? If you wish, these are still the waves that can still be attributed to Moses, okay? But although he's dead and buried, okay, his influence is still such that you can't get away. And even in the first chapter of the book of Joshua, there are twice as many references to him as there are to Joshua himself. Now, the critical verses here are the ones that I've highlighted in green. Okay. God speaks to Joshua now in this opening chapter of the book that bears his name. And he says to him, okay, in verse 5, Lo yityasev ish lefanecha, no one will be able to oppose you in your lifetime. Kasher hayiti im Moshe ehye imach, I will have the same relationship with you as I had with Moses. Lo arpecha v'lo e'ezveka, I will neither abandon you nor fail you. Okay? Chazak ve'ematz, right? Be strong and of good courage. Why does Joshua need strength and courage? Because he is the one who is going to have to conquer the land of Israel and to apportion it to the people, as God had promised to their ancestors. And he even repeats it, Rak chazak ve'ematz, and even adds the adverb ma'od. He tells Joshua, you know, Joshua, maybe it isn't even enough just to be strong and courageous. You're going to have to be only strong and courageous, meaning those are the dispositions that you have to show all the time. And it isn't even enough to show your ordinary strength and courage. You have to be very strong and very courageous. And you see again that that same phrase, chazak ve'ematz, is repeated again here in verse 9. And it comes again at the very end of the Haftarah. It's the three concluding words in the Haftarah. Just be strong and of good courage. If God has to tell Joshua 4 times in one sitting, so to speak, to be very strong and very courageous, clearly God knows that Joshua is going to face a considerable challenge in leading the people. After all, although Joshua was the servant of Moses and was able to observe Moses' leadership of the Jewish people throughout the 40 years in the wilderness, and since Joshua, in the instance of the spies, had clearly shown himself to be devoted to God and willing even to stand up against the other 10 spies and to deliver a truer report of the land of Israel, so clearly he had already demonstrated strength and courage, right? Remember, he was the commander who led the Jews into battle against the Amalekites shortly after the exodus from Egypt. So he clearly has earned his stripes, so to speak, okay? And he's demonstrated his strength and his courage. And yet, the fact that the people tested Moses' leadership so often and so strenuously throughout those 40 years, clearly God understood that this was going to be a challenge for Joshua himself. So, what is chazak ve'ematz, and what are the consequences of it, and why does it say rak chazak ve'ematz? Just be strong and courageous, as though there were an alternative to it. Why would you consider him, why would he ever consider not being strong and courageous? So the curious thing with which I want to conclude today is indeed that the rabbis in the Talmud and later the medieval exegetes read some particular significance into this. And that's based on a linguistic observation that the word rak, only, is a form of, it's restrictive. It's when you say only, you're excluding everything else. Okay. There's a Talmudic proverb that says, achim v'rakim, right? Every time you find the word ach, which means however or but, okay, or rak, only or just, mi utim, then clearly it is their intention to eliminate something else. It's a restrictive form. So the question that they're asking themselves is, what is being restricted here? So here the Radak, Rabbi David Kimchi, the 13th century Provençal commentator, cites the Talmud, the Talmudic proverb, and he says, Darshu Rabotenu Zal, that our sainted rabbis learned the following, Yachol Afilu Lidvar Aveira. Okay, remember, the concluding verse says, look at it again, verse 18, that anyone who rebels against Joshua, anyone who disobeys him, okay, L'chol asher titzavenu, right, who will not carry out any one of Joshua's instructions, yumat, right, is guilty of treason and will suffer the death penalty. So they ask a question. What if Joshua were to command someone to do something that's illegal? Right, something that we come up against many times, right? The classic being either Nuremberg, right? I was only following orders, or Milai, I was only following orders, right? And it even unfortunately comes up periodically in Israel today, okay? So what in fact is the law if a commanding officer, a higher officer, orders a lower ranking officer to do something, okay? And he follows the order, and turns out that the order was illegal. Who's responsible? Okay. So the Radak, citing the Talmud, says, Yachol afilu ledvar avira. Is God telling Joshua that whatever he tells people to do, they have to follow on the pain of death, even if he tells them to do something illegal? No. That's why the verse incorporated the word rak, which is a restrictive term. Okay. Achin v'rakin miutim hem. These are forms of limitation or restriction. And what does it restrict? It means that you only need to follow your superior officer's orders if those orders are legal. Okay? If the orders are not legal, then lower-ranking soldiers have the right to disobey them. Now, of course, the question arises, okay, in the heat of battle, and particularly nowadays when you don't necessarily see the enemy against whom you're, you know, fighting. What if a soldier is ordered to do something that he doesn't know whether it's legal or illegal? Whose responsibility is it? Is it still the individual soldier's responsibility to figure out whether he's giving a legal order or an illegal order? Look what Radak says in his commentary on the book of Samuel. This is apropos of the verse in which the prophet Nathan tells King David that that he has displeased God. He has displeased him because he has taken Bathsheba to be his wife under rather questionable circumstances, and that the questionable circumstance led to the death of her husband, Uriah the Chiti. And it says, the language that he uses in rebuking David is, V'oto, that is referring to Uriah, oto, him, haragta, you killed him, b'cherev b'nei Ammon. Now, David wasn't even in battle, okay? The Ammonites killed Uriah, but the prophet says to David, you're responsible for his death. So, Radak says as follows, even though our sages maintained that there is a universal rule, the universal rule is Ein Shaliach Lidvar Aveira. That means that there is no agency for the commission of a crime. Meaning that if you hire somebody to commit a crime, okay, then the person who goes out and commits the crime, if in fact he knows that it's criminal, cannot turn around, point a finger, and say, oh no, he hired me to do it. Okay? If you commit a crime and you know that it's a crime, then you bear the responsibility for it personally. Okay? It says, even though that's the rule. So in this case, David appointed somebody else to see that Uriah would be killed. So arguably, the responsibility should belong to the person who killed Uriah, not to David. So he says, no, this is an exception. Why is it an exception? Lefi shahaya melech ve'ein over al mitzvato. He says, you know, there's a place, pardon me, it's not Radak's term, there's a place where the buck stops. And the buck stops, in this case, in the biblical case, it stops at the king. Meaning, if the king gives an order, then everybody from the commander-in-chief down to the private in the front ranks, okay, has the right to assume that it's a legitimate order. Why? Because ein over al mitzvato, because people in general, just as people, at least in the ancient world and in the Middle Ages, were conditioned to follow a king's orders automatically, right, reflexively, okay, so it is in any army. What training did soldiers go through besides physical training and learning how to shoot a weapon? Okay, what the training they go through is to obey orders. Therefore, since ultimately the chain of command goes up to the king, then there's no place else for the responsibility to rest, and it rests with the king. And with that, we'll take a quick look at the chat.
I didn't understand why you said that they couldn't.
Give me a second.
Possibly.
Sorry, give me a second, please. I just want to look first.
Okay.
Oh, Rabbi Kelman posted that they're having trouble with the website, and the sources will be posted as soon as it's corrected. Is that Sarah, the kernel from which we have Isruchag? A kernel, certainly not linguistically. Isruchag is a little different. Comes from a different verse. Comes from a verse that we recite in Hallel. Isruchag ba'avotim, as though we want to tie the holiday or our observance of the holiday with ropes, as it were, attach it to the temple so that we can't part company from it. A blessing of Solomon when he inaugurated the temple echoes that of Aaron. As I said, that's certainly one of the most significant prayers recorded in the Tanakh. I'm sorry, somebody had a question?
Yes, I didn't understand why you felt it wasn't possible that they sacrificed 120,000 korbanos.
Well, it'd be 142,000 or something like that, counting the oxen.
Right.
And it's obviously much more difficult and complicated and time-consuming to slaughter an ox than it is to slaughter a sheep. But nevertheless, just figure out, I mean, the minimum amount of time that it's got to take to slit the animal's throat and to remove the entrails and everything else. It's just not conceivable that it could all be done in one day on one altar. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. I don't think it can be tested. It's just my sense of it. I just think it's too much in excess of anything that's realistic. So as I said, either they weren't technical sacrifices. They weren't sacrifices in the technical sense. So it didn't require Kohanim to slaughter them, and they didn't have to be done on the Mizbeach. It could simply be done anywheres in order to provide food for people on the holiday. And it's not unlikely, because it happens elsewhere in the Bible, that these are not exact numbers, right? These are exaggerated numbers.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Rabbi Sattler, okay. A quick question.
Yes. Sure.
Is Yoav absolved of guilt based on what you just said?
Is who, sorry?
Yoav.
Actually a chapter in my last book. I tell you what, if you send an email to me, msokolo@yu.edu, and you just write in the subject line, Yoav. Okay. I'll send you that chapter.
Thank you very much.
Okay? Sure. It's actually a sugya, so to speak, in Masechet Sanhedrin. I'll be glad to send it to you.
Thank you.
One more question. I see that you're muted. Ah, now
yes.
You're not. Yes.
Okay. Yesterday in the Yom Kippur Machzor at the very beginning, Rabbi Sachs has an essay about those primitive Yom Kippurs. And he actually says and counts out, he says, there was a letter written by a witness from Rome. And it says, Lefienai, I actually saw these things, and they saw the processions of 20,000 of these, 30,000 of those, 50,000 of these, and they mean people and Kohanim. And so, in light of this, my husband pointed this out to me yesterday. He said, Sandra, can you imagine the first Yom Kippur, those first Yom Kippurs, they were nuts. It was like Woodstock for the holy and crazy. I mean, don't even think of the foods, the toilets, the logistical problems. But if all of this is true, how, I have to second you and say, where, how did they slaughter 120,000? I think they needed them, and they weren't just for Kadosh Kadosh. They needed them. Somebody needed to eat. Yeah. So I don't know what it was like.
I don't know. The closest we come to it is that famous Mishnah that talks about Asarani Simna Asula Avotenu Bevet HaMikdash, that there were 10 things related to the temple that were miraculous, and one of them, Shehechzik HaMu'ata Tamiru Beh. Because if you go back and look at the dimensions of the temple, right? The dimensions of the temple, we think of the temple. I don't know what building, comes to mind if you think of, the Beit HaMikdash, the Taj Mahal, Buckingham Palace, or something like that. The inner courtyard of the temple was not much bigger than a basketball court. So that's the inner court. I don't know how many people, but if Madison Square Garden only sits 50,000 people, okay, so you got to imagine that in order to contain that number of people, they either had to simply go in shifts. I mean, they just simply continuously that they came and they bowed down or whatever it is, and then they kept on moving to make room for the people behind them, or as I said, it's just exaggeration. Okay, once
could
again,
just, I remind could you just today. Give us your email again? What is your email?
Letter M followed by the name Sokolow, Sokolow at yu.edu.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And I wish you all a forthcoming Chag Sameach. And we will conclude this series on Tuesday, the second day of Chol HaMoed Sukkot, when we finally get to fulfill the promise of the title. And we've already gone from Hannah's prayer, and we've touched base with Rachel's tomb. So somehow we have to find our way to the skin of the Leviathan. So I promise you we'll get there, and see you then. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good day.